This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, They shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by a front, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, we here over the years have extensively covered shooting deaths of unarmed men and women of color in America. We've raised the question, why so often, more so than white people, why the lack of justice for the victims' families, and why lawmakers have been so reluctant to forward true reforms to address the issue. And now a new study reveals alarming rise in fatal U.S. police encounters disproportionately targeting black and Latino communities. Now, according to a mapping initiative by Campaign Zero, number of deadly police encounters hit a decade high in 2024. Data shows more than 1,300 people were killed by U.S. police last year, most of them black and Latino, as the two groups make up a much smaller portion of the U.S. population than do white people. Now, this continued disproportionate campaign of people of color targeted by U.S. law enforcement is the focus of today's Spotlight program. And now for our guests. We have joining us Mr. Abiyomi Ezekiwe, editor at Pan-African Newswire, joining us from Detroit. And Mr. Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist, joining us out of Toronto. Hello, gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess, Mr. Abiyomi Ezekiwe, we're going to start with you. Okay, let's see this. According to this report, in Chicago, black residents were 30 times more likely to be killed than white residents. 30 times more likely. In St. Louis, Missouri, the rate was over 10 times higher. Let's start with the program. Why do you think these numbers in America are so, and have been for so long, so skewed?
It has a lot to do with institutional racism. It has also plenty to do with the history forced removals, exploitation, mass incarceration, And as a mechanism of social control, you have the police, you have law enforcement, there are the courts, then there's the prosecutors, and of course the places of detention, whether it's the jails, the prisons, or people who are outside but still being supervised judicially. So these are the reasons why this has been a problem for decades after decades. In Chicago, the police have had a notorious reputation for many, many years. It's been a flashpoint for urban rebellions. We remember people such as Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, who were gunned down at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning in 1969, members of the Black Panther Party. In St. Louis, that was a flashpoint as well in 2014, with the murder of Mike Brown, the uprisings that took place in Ferguson. So it's continuing, and the government is not doing anything about it because it's in their interest to maintain this type of social control over the oppressed populations of the U.S.
Right, and I'm glad you mentioned a few names because you remember 12-year-old Tamir Rice there in Cleveland, Ohio. Yes. I believe it was back in November of 2014. You remember Eric Garner and George Floyd both choked to death on live camera. And all the protests that ensued and all the promises made. So what happened?
Well, you had the election of Joe Biden in 2020, and they made a lot of promises to the African-American and Latino community in the United States. They were going to pass a George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. It was never passed. They were going to do other things to recorrect some of the problems associated with policing in people of color communities, and it wasn't done. And the following year, he came out during the State of the Nation address and said they did not want to defund the police. They wanted more money for the police, for training, and other purposes. So I think this had a lot to do as well with the defeat of Kamala Harris just last year, because she could not go against the track record of the Biden administration.
Okay, let's get beyond Joe Biden. How about Barack Obama? He made a lot of campaign pledges. A lot of people feel he did not show the sense of urgency once in office. Kamala Harris, same thing. Here's a person of color put in a leading role as a vice president. Even when she ran for presidency, she did not use police reform on her platform. Why? Why, when you can't rely on people of color to bat for people of color, what options do you have left?
The only options that people really have is independent actions, protesting in the streets, mass rebellions. There needs to be some type of organized electoral response to this continuing problem. As you mentioned, we did not have that here in the U.S. last year. Both of the major candidates, neither one of them spoke against police brutality. So it's a serious problem. And I think it's going to continue because you have a rising rate of people of color within the broader U.S. population. That is a concern, not only for the Republicans, but also for the Democrats. And this immigration policy that they're trying to enforce right now under the most recent Trump administration is also racist. They're using the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and they're going after people largely from Mexico, from Central America, South America, from Haiti, from Africa, and so forth. So they want to keep down the numbers of people of color inside the United States because it's rapidly increasing. It's estimated that by the middle of this century, half the population in the United States will be people of color. That is the black people, the brown people, people from West Asia, the Middle East. So that is what the ruling class in this country is very much concerned about.
And sir, this report also says that the rise comes as the momentum for police reform has died 5 years after the 2020 murder of George Floyd and as President Trump ends initiatives aimed at reducing police misconduct. Aside from we're going to talk about Donald Trump in a second, but why do you think concern is waning? You remember 5 years ago, people were fired up on this issue, and that is, for the most part, died down and lost a lot of steam. Why?
Well, we don't have the long-term outlook. We don't have the organizational capacity to continue those struggles here in the United States. Also, people were actually set back by the election of Joe Biden, in a sense. It was considered a victory because it stopped Trump from having a second consecutive term. But at the same time, his history in regard to race relations and police community relations has not been good. So the fact that people did not continue to protest, they did not continue to rebel after Joe Biden was elected, of course, has a lot to do with the fact that these repressive actions are continuing here in the United States. And they will continue because right now there's not even a pretext on the part of the current administration. It's almost no African-Americans in the cabinet. Even if it was, it wouldn't make that much difference because they'd have to accept the line of Donald Trump. But the fact that you have essentially a white supremacist government right now in the United States means that the police have been given even more of a green light to carry out repressive measures, particularly in the African-American and Latino-American communities.
And Mr. Ezekiel, you very well know, you mentioned mass incarceration in America. Per capita, I believe it has more people in prison than any civilization in history. My question, right. and part of it is capitalization. It's the fact that incarceration is big business in America. You have a whole bunch of private prisons where people with a lot of money can set up, build their own prisons. Sometimes they have a holding that builds multiple prisons, and they charge the government $500-$600 a day to incarcerate each inmate in these prisons. So guess what? Now you got to basically produce inmates. So when you cross and you put together incarceration with capitalization, it's pretty much a recipe for disaster that the minority population is going to bear the brunt of, isn't it?
It is. And it is a big money-making industry. That is the punitive incarceration industry in the United States. Over 2 million people are now incarcerated in jails and in prisons and halfway houses across the United States. And that outstrips per capita any other country in the world. And there's no effort to try to lessen the rate of incarceration inside the United States. And with the economic crisis that is bound to increase because of the irrational economic policies of the current administration, there are going to be more people who are going to be thrown in prison for committing crimes, which are crimes that really deal with survival, people who don't have jobs, who can't afford adequate housing, who have problems related to psychological disorders. All of those areas right now are going to worsen because of the current administration. Yes, this country is a highly incarcerated country. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the journalist from Pennsylvania, calls it prison nation. And it has always been a highly repressive atmosphere in this country. We have to remember, the indigenous people in this country were driven off their land. They were put on reservations. Many of them died. My ancestors were brought here from Africa. Millions of them are incarcerated for 250 years as enslaved people. And since that time period, we have never gained complete equality and self-determination and freedom inside the United States. So this is part and parcel of the repressive apparatus of U.S. capitalism and imperialism. And they have spread this all over the world. If you look at all these wars that are taking place right now, all of it has to do with domination and economic exploitation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
You mentioned these prison populations. You very well know disproportionately they're people of color, and you can't attribute it to a social class thing, because there are more poor white people in America than any other group. So basically, why are the prison populations disproportionately black and brown?
Yes, it goes back to what was mentioned before, the rising population of people of color inside the United States is viewed as a threat by the ruling interests in this country. So in locking people up, you take them out of society, they can very well get deathly ill inside of a prison. They could die inside of a prison. They could be killed by the police. So all of these things are done.
Not to mention they cannot reproduce. And they cannot reproduce.
Yes, most definitely. And that is an idea that they have that will maintain a lower birth rate among oppressed people inside the United States. So all of these factors are involved in regard to the whole prison industrial complex inside of the United States. It is a business. It's a big business. And all these prisons that are built in every state all across the United States bring in money. And a lot of these prisons are being built in largely white areas, rural communities, where they already have a lot of poverty. And this provides jobs for whites who live in these areas. And their job is to guard black people and brown people for as long as you can keep them there in order to maintain the system's status quo.
And now I'm glad we mentioned Donald Trump earlier, because I want to set a question aside just for current U.S. president. President Trump campaigned on ending all Department of Justice pattern and practice investigations into troubled police departments. My question to you, Mr. Abiyomi Ezekiwe, is how does U.S. leadership impact law enforcement violence today in America?
Yeah, well, the Justice Department is under the White House. They're the ones who initiate investigations into police misconduct. Here in Detroit, years ago, 20 years ago, there was the imposition of a consent judgment against the Detroit Police Department for the use of excessive force and for the horrible conditions that existed in the lockups. This lasted for about a decade. Then it was lifted due to an imposed municipal bankruptcy, which was really illegal. So this is what is happening. They can lift it. The Justice Department can decide that this police department has met all requirements, and it should be lifted. Any type of monitoring of the police by the federal government will no longer be enforced. So Trump is doing this as a olive branch to local law enforcement agencies across the country, because they do not want to be monitored and they do not want to be cited for excesses, if it's related to excessive force or whether it's related to the horrible conditions that exist in the jails and in the prisons in the United States. So, yes, he's doing that to maintain the support of law enforcement and also of his conservative and right-wing base in the United States.
And how do you, sir, address this disproportionate targeting of people of color by U.S. law enforcement once and for all? Or is this phenomena, from your perspective, so deeply entrenched and ingrained in police culture that there's no remedy for it?
Well, that's why people have been calling for defunding of the police, dismantling of the police. Also, the abolitionists today, it refers to the abolishment of prisons and jails in the United States. So that is the only reason why this system is continuing. If people, for example, realize that the entire criminal justice system in this country is doing nothing to solve crime or to improve the social conditions of people in the United States, then people will come around to the idea that, yes, policing needs to be drastically reoriented, and so does the punitive criminal justice system in this country. So it needs to be abolished. The whole system of racism, of capitalism, needs to be reformed. It needs to be transformed into something that is more equal and that is more just for the majority of people inside the United States. And this question is not going to go away. It's not going to go away because of the fact that the economic situation that we're facing here in the United States is going to be dire. And when that happens, that's going to create even more tensions, more demonstrations, more rebellions, and also more people being repressed by the police. So it has to be an overall transformation of the criminal justice system in the United States in order to really get at solving this problem.
And beyond the undertones of racism, sir, do you feel U.S. police are simply more aggressive and more violent than police elsewhere in the world?
It's a good question. I know that here in this country, they have a horrible track record for brutality. It goes back to the period of enslavement and the forced removal of the indigenous people. The organization of police forces in the United States was patterned heavily on the slave system. So that continues, even though slavery has been legally abolished, but the 13th Amendment does within it allow for enslavement, involuntary servitude, if you are incarcerated in a correctional facility. So in a sense, slavery continues in the United States because the 13th Amendment allows the government to have people work for free by force, and they totally take over your movement. And also they have a lot to do with your future activities, because if you have a criminal record, it's very difficult for people in the United States to find viable work, to find opportunities to advance their education, and also even housing. Some government housing programs will not allow people in them if they have a criminal record, if they've been convicted of a misdemeanor or a felony. So it's rooted in the entire oppressive and exploitative system of the United States.
And I want to ask you one final question. This study by Campaign Zero, it says that last year in 2024, over 1,370 murders by police, by law enforcement against people, and most of them people of color. Now, my question here is, while police violence rose last year to its most since 2013, after nearly 11 years, the overall homicide and violent crime throughout the country declined. What do you attribute to this sudden spike in violence over the last couple of years, culminating in these record numbers last year?
Yeah, well, that has been the case all along. You know, as the late Malcolm X once said, that in the black community in the United States, you have more police than any other community, but at the same time, you have more crime. So his conclusion was that the police must be in cahoots with the criminal activities taking place in the African-American communities. Mm. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a rise in crime in order to see more violence carried out by the police against civilians. It's an attitude that exists. It's a system that they're trying to protect, and it will continue until we are able to organize to transform the system into one that is much more just and equal for oppressed and working class people in this country.
And what's your level of optimism or pessimism to that in that respect?
Well, we are human beings, and we can fight, we can organize, we can mobilize, and it may take time, but eventually any unjust system will collapse, people will rise up against it, and there will be change. And we've seen it in other parts of the world. And I really believe strongly that the contradictions in this country will force people to rise up against the unjust system.
I want to thank you for joining us on the program, Mr. Abiyomi Ezekwu. I want to apologize. You're our sole guest tonight. We had an honor of spending the time with you alone. We lost Mr. Eric Wahlberg earlier on in the program, and I want to also apologize for that. That was just us and Mr. Abiyomi Ezekwu having a one-on-one. Editor at Pan-African Newswire joining us there out of Detroit, Michigan. And this brings us to the end of this segment of your Spotlight program, everyone. Thank you for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite youth station. Well, this is Asma. I'm so happy to be here again in the cozy, sweet corner. And then with me I have...
Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam. Well, how's everything, brother?
Alhamdulillah, everything's good. What do you have to say about the spiritual practices? Like, how do you take out time for your spiritual practices? And how do you, like, schedule it?
First of all, I ask myself, how much of your daily life do you devote on spiritual thinking? Mm-hmm. How much do you spend with your Lord on a daily basis? Like every day, when you, from the time when you wake up until the time when you again end up sleeping, do you devote any special time for talking to Him, for evaluating yourself, assessing whatever you have done throughout the day? Do you even devote such a time for that? And then from one phase to other phase of my life, the answer is going to be different. Sometimes you're busy doing the stuff you have to do. Like, for example, if you're a man and you're working for your family, you're the breadwinner. And in today's life, in this modern materialistic life, mm-hmm. bringing that bread is such a drudgery. To keep the household in a best condition and situation possible is a difficult task. That person, the time he would probably devote for spiritual activities and practices would differ from a person who is at home, not having too much of responsibilities, and everything is paved for them.
To understand this in a better way, so first we should look at the, what do we mean by spiritual activities?
Yeah.
So that we could differentiate, like, you know, how we spend time for that, how we take out time for that.
Yeah. And then I would say that, first, as to define that a spiritual activity, I told you that it comes to my mind, it appears to me that a spiritual activity is the time that I would devote for God. But mm-hmm. if, as we have been asked to be very much shrewd and clever about whatever we do as Muslims, if I am a doctor, if I am a teacher, if I am a student even... And we have it also in our narrations that as students, from the very moment that they step out of their house and go for learning new stuff with this intention, it's as if there are many angels accompanying them. So they are doing something worthy because mm-hmm. they're going to end up as an important part of their society to help other people. So yeah. I was just saying that. If I am clever enough to realize that God has devoted... an amount of worth for whatever I do, if I have good intention, that I would take this as what I'm saying right now, that as a teacher, if I'm a teacher and I do not have enough of time to devote for, to call it like this specific time for my spiritual activity, then what I would do at school, at an institute, wherever, mm-hmm. for even one person, if I am just teaching them with this intention that I teach them good stuff to improve themselves, to help their society, to enlighten themselves into a better version of themselves, then I would be doing that as spiritual activity.
Exactly. That's what I wanted to convey to our audience today. That, you know, I want to present an idea which is in a different way, which is not usually perceived by the audience, by the common people in this way. So like spiritual activities, they deem to be devoting time for religion, devoting
time like
for
worshiping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. All the time.
So, you know, I'm working like morning to evening. I come back, I eat food, like I spend some time with my family. Okay, then now I've got like 15 minutes. I read.
Which I'm dead tired, by the way.
So now I take out the book, holy book, and I read a few pages of the Quran. And now I got some free time. Like, I go and pray Salat. So this is what they think is like, you know, okay, I'm taking out like half an hour of my daily life for spiritual practices. So this is not just spiritual practice. What I say is spiritual practice is everyday life.
Every moment of your life could be a spiritual act.
Yeah, it's not necessarily... it's the intentions. Al-a'malu
bin-niyyah. Exactly.
Whatever your actions are, they're based on your intentions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're working in a company, if you're working for your family, if you're the breadwinner of your family, it doesn't mean that, you know, it's not something other than spiritual activity.
Exactly.
It is actually a spiritual activity. So there's a hadith from Imam Hassan al-Mustaba alayhi salam. Work for your life as if you live forever.
Yeah.
So which means that, you know, you need to work hard for your family, for yourself, for your community, not just for yourself.
For your responsibilities.
Yeah. You've got responsibilities. So work hard, do great things. Become wealthy, earn some wealth, so, you know, work hard and help people, help yourself, like improve yourself, improve the community.
Exactly.
So the first part goes like, work for your life as if you live forever. So it means like, you know, you have the thought in your mind like, oh, I'm living for
forever. I have an eternity. Like,
for example, yeah, I'm living for eternity,
yeah,
like unlimited time. So I need to work more. Mm-hmm. I need to work hard so that I could survive. But the next part of the hadith, work for your afterlife as if you die tomorrow.
Exactly.
So this is a reminder.
You must have both at the same time.
Yeah, so you're
they're
balancing.
They're inseparable.
You're working for your life. You're working to earn money. But you have it in your mind.
Yeah.
Oh, tomorrow I have to go in front of my Lord.
Yeah.
All my a'mal, all my actions are going to be present.
Yeah.
Presented to me.
The thing that I would have in my account is only my action.
Yeah, so I would be accountable for everything.
Exactly.
So you're working hard for your life, but you have in your mind about the akhirat, about afterlife, about everything, about the consequences of it.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Well, you know, I usually think about my major, that how could I use my major to be a part of my spiritual activity? Like, how would I be doing a lot of things for my major and at the same time, in that way, simultaneously, I would be doing for my hereafter as well. Then I saw a painter, because I usually think about at this point that what are the purposes of an artist? Like, if you are a writer, if you're mm-hmm. a painter, if you're a poet, whatever you are, how could you apply all your hard works and efforts in a direction that would be considered as a spiritual activity? And then I saw that painter who was working on a work, actually, a painting by himself for more than a month. And then I thought, okay, all these moments are gone for only one painting.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you claim in the hereafter that I was spending my life for God? And then when the painting was over, based on the feedback of people, I realized that sometimes you, even as the person who maybe you are making perfumes, maybe with your hands, you're going to create a work of art, whatever, be it a garden, be it a painting, be it a book, a poem, anything. Maybe it has been a mission that has been imposed on you to create that work of art, to bring one person back into the real direction, into the truthful direction of being a perfect human being. When his work was over, based on the feedbacks of people, they were so touched by the image, and that image was so, you know, it was thought-provoking, so mm-hmm. much thought-provoking. And everybody out there who saw that, based on their feedbacks, you could have said that this guy has done a very important thing, like a prophet. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I mean, sometimes you become a mean for people's realization of the truth. So all that month in which that painter was trying to create a work of art mm-hmm. is actually maybe like a pilgrim. Mm-hmm. Maybe he was going through a direction that would actually purify him. Because if it wasn't like that, then he wouldn't have created such a work that would affect many people. I mean, like throughout the world, mm-hmm. not just a simple community. No, in a larger scale, you would bring the world into a halt and make people think.
Yeah.
So whatever you do in this world, if you have this good intention, you are doing a spiritual activity.
Exactly. We're talking about the intentions, when you talk and talking about the spirituality or spiritual activities, not necessarily it's like something
like everyday fasting, like everyday worship. I'm not saying that these things are bad.
It's not certainly a few actions.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so this action is spiritual, this is not. Spirituality or spiritual activity could be anything.
Anything.
Anything. Any,
helping
your daily,
a blind man cross the street.
Day-to-day chores. Oh, that's a good deed. That's actually a very good thing, like helping others. I'm talking about normal things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, eating pizza. There are two people who are eating a pizza.
Yeah.
So one person is just eating a pizza. The other person, he's eating a pizza, but he's also involved in some spiritual activity. What is that? He's eating a pizza, but he's got it in his mind because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made it halal upon me so I can enjoy this pizza. So even now, he's remembering his Lord.
Yeah.
So these small things, you know, you're walking in the garden, you're remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You're thanking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, like earning bread.
Yeah.
So people think like, you know, okay, so we're not getting time to do other things. We're not getting time to do religious activities or something. So, you know, one of the most emphasized things in Islam with great merits is halal income.
Yeah.
You know, working for your family.
Mm-hmm.
You're working because you're trying to gain some halal income.
And your intention
is... And you just try to be gratitude, like grateful of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is the very essence mm-hmm. of spirituality.
And your intention is actually to breed about children who are going to be a help for the entire human beings, for their own society. So this is a big thing for itself. Like, this is the spiritual act. God does not expect us to be worshipping all the time. I do believe that. Now, the time is up and it's just the final month. Like, I'm just ending today's episode with these words that what God expects from us is to be real human beings. And the whole idea of creation is worshiping. And by worshiping, I don't think he means that all the time you must be participating in the act of worshiping, like praying all the time or like everything that we have in our religion. It's not just that. I'm not saying that that sort of worshiping is bad.
Yeah.
I say that it's not the entire purpose of worship. The purpose of worshiping was to remember God in every single act that we do in our life.
Exactly.
Even if it is taking care of your children, taking care of your neighbors, of your family member, I don't know, anyone. Of the people that are dear to you and of the people that are strange to you.
Mm-hmm.
They're strangers actually to you. So the whole idea is that you have this remembrance of God. Whatever you do it with the intention that I'm doing this because God is watching it. Because God is here.
Make this thing in your, just make this thing clear in your mind. Like God is watching, Allah is watching everything. And whatever is happening in this world is not happening but from the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Exactly. So the intention is very important. Whatever you do, the whole idea is that you keep remembering that God is here, God is there and is watching you, and you have Him there. The whole idea is that. So whatever you do, if you have these intentions in your mind, then I guess would be considered as a spiritual act. And if you have that blessing of having extra time to devote, to wake up at the night, at the heart of the night, to speak to Him, and to be doing that directly, then that would be an extra happiness. So this was all for today. I hope you have just enjoyed it. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings. be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Limelight. Academics and scientists who work with the National Institutes of Health said the Trump administration's orders have severely disrupted their work, delaying projects and casting the future of research funding and jobs into doubt as chaos in the agency reigns. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website First Word Pharma has covered this story and tells us more. The Trump administration has blocked a crucial step in the National Institutes of Health process for funding medical research, likely in violation of federal judges' temporary restraining order on federal funding freezes. The National Institutes of Health has stopped submitting study sections, meetings in which scientists peer-review National Institutes of Health grant funding proposals to the Federal Register after the Trump administration paused health agency communications. By law, study sections must appear on the register 15 days in advance of meetings. Jeremy Berg, a biochemist who has overseen National Institutes of Health funding in the past, said, "The idea is that the public has the right to know who's giving advice to the federal government and when they're meeting. These meetings are integral in the funding process for scientists at institutions around the country, researching virtually all elements of disease and medicine, including drug development, cancer research, heart disease, and aging." An internal National Institute of Health email confirmed that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has instructed the National Institutes of Health to indefinitely hold Federal Register submissions. Carol Labone, a Northwestern University biologist who runs a stem cell laboratory and has participated in study sections, said, "By doing this, they effectively shut down their extramural research program." According to Samuel Begenstos, a law professor at the University of Michigan who served as the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services General Counsel until December of 2024, this is a clear violation of federal judges' orders. Samuel Begenstos said Judge John McConnell initially issued a temporary restraining order saying stop the funding, pause, and then, after receiving evidence that the Trump administration was trying to evade that order, he issued a further, broader order saying that, first of all, the Trump administration must immediately end any federal funding pause. And secondly, this is the crucial language, including clearing any administrative, operational or technical hurdles to implementation. Samuel Begenstos added, "So this idea that we're going to spend the money, but we're only going to spend the money after we have study sections, and oops, we can't have study sections because we're not allowing notices of study sections to be filed in the Federal Register, unambiguously ignores that language. Bagenstor says if the Trump administration continues to evade court orders, judges have a number of tools at their disposal. They could issue more specific orders directed towards individuals responsible for violations, or even hold them in civil contempt of court, which can include jail time and which cannot be undone with a presidential pardon. We continue with the First World Farmers coverage of this story. Jeremy Berg said study sections bring scientists from institutions around the country together to peer-review grant proposals. Each study section brings 20 or more peer reviewers together to review as many as 100 proposals. Jeremy Berg said it's basically about 2 weeks of work for each reviewer. A source familiar with the process estimated that for every 3 days worth of delayed study sections, $1 billion of National Institute of Health funding is put on hold. Even though study sections are required to appear on the Federal Register 15 days in advance, meetings scheduled to begin on 20th of February were postponed the day before. One scientist, who was supposed to have her grant proposal reviewed, said, "In recent days, without warning, as we were checking in to our flights for Washington, D.C., my study section was cancelled for no reason." The cancellations led the scientist and her colleagues to collectively put together that the problem was related to the Federal Register, relatively obscure step in the process. Two scientists scheduled to attend the 20th of February study sections as reviewers said they had never heard about the requirement until this week. One suspected the maneuver is another clever way to wage war on medical science because few people, even those who work at the National Institutes of Health, completely understand how it works. He said it is a logistical thing that someone like me would never have to interact with or likely would never have heard of. None of the scientists received an explanation as to why study sections were not cancelled until the last minute, even though they were required to appear on the Federal Register 15 days in advance, but never did. Labonne suspects it's because the National Institute of Health staff are still hoping the meetings can go forward somehow. Labonne explained, "They're trying to keep it possible till the very last minute in hopes that someone has mercy and allows study sections to continue, and maybe even waives the 15-day requirement." Stuart Buck, a Harvard law graduate and executive director of the Good Science Project, says these moves make it very hard to read the tea leaves about what will happen next. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Academics and scientists who work with the National Institutes of Health said the Trump administration's orders have severely disrupted their work, delaying projects and casting the future of research funding and jobs into doubt. An array of orders seeks to fundamentally reshape the National Institute of Health, the world's largest public funder of biomedical and behavioral research, in the Trump administration's image. The agency's work is the wellspring of scientific advancement in the United States and helped make the country a so-called dominant force in healthcare and medical sciences. Todd Wolfson, the president of the American Association of University Professors and an anthropologist at Rutgers University in New Jersey, said, they will have drastic effects on all of us. This is not a hyperbole, this is fact. Todd Wolfson said the orders will kill as advances in the treatment of diseases as diverse as cancer, Alzheimer's disease and diabetes. Wolfson said Donald Trump and Elon Musk are taking a sledgehammer to the greatest biomedical infrastructure in the world to extend tax cuts. National Institutes of Health-funded basic or applied research has also contributed to 386 of the 387 drugs the Food and Drug Administration approved between the years 2000 and 2019, and more than 100 Nobel Prizes have been awarded to scientists based on National Institutes of Health-funded work. The National Institute of Health grants often fund basic research conducted at universities and colleges across the country, touching every state and nearly every congressional district. Since taking office, the Trump administration has issued a bevy of executive orders and administrative actions that seek to fundamentally alter American health and biomedical science agencies, from appointing the nation's foremost vaccine critic to head the Department of Health and Human Services to scrubbing websites of information the administration finds objectionable. Donald Trump's executive orders prohibit grant funding containing a long list of words associated with diversity, equity, and inclusion. Attempts to cut scientific research funding by $4 billion, fires thousands of employees and stopped recruitment, imposed communications blackouts, and blocked committees from meeting to evaluate new scientific research, effectively freezing medical research funds.